Accession number 28678, Mr. Dermot Road, Real 12. Now, what about what happened next? I mean, what was your next posting after you left there in late 74?
Next was another very big step, because by then, C appointments were again by selection, and I was selected for C command, which meant frigate or destroyer, well, frigate, really, which was a source of great joy, of course. Going back to C in command was what everybody aspired to. And I was appointed to command HMS Ashanti, which is another tribal class frigate, similar to the one, well, a sister ship of the one I'd served in as,
exactly the same
as a gunnery officer.
And this started what, late?
Well, there's before commanding officers go to any ships, they have to undergo a series of commanding officers designate courses, which lasts about 3 or 4 months. So at the end of 1974-ish, beginning of 75, no, beginning of 75, I think, I was sent off on these courses.
Now, what were these courses? Tell us what you studied on them.
Well, you again, this is a tour of the various specialist schools, and they update you on the weapon systems and equipment fitted in your ship, and they bring you up to date with all the latest teaching and practices, and that includes tactics, as well as all about the hardware, all the rules and regulations. It's quite comprehensive, but I knew quite well, because I actually used to teach these guys when I was on the staff of the gunnery school. But you do go round, and you are, this is the top course, and every establishment is trying to impress you, so you tend to get very good lunches, and they're looked after by normally by the captain or the commander or the senior officers there, and sat in armchairs for your lectures, which is not very good after a very good lunch. And so we did a number of those.
Had you fallen behind, or in a sense, over the year or two, or were you up to speed, basically?
Well, no, you did. I mean, there, I'd just done 2 years with the Ministry of a procurement executive, and so I was a bit. I mean, you obviously keep up as much as you can in interest and talking to your friends, but you might get a bit sort of left behind in some aspects of remote specialisations or subjects that you weren't intimately connected with. I was certainly well up on the missile and gunnery side, and so I didn't do that course. There was no point in me wasting time going on that course, except I did drop in to, because my other course colleagues, you sort of chat over the bar all of an evening and can help them. But I certainly went to all the others and enjoyed them. The supply, you went to the supply school for a day or two. We also, as commanding officers, had to go through the helicopter dunking course. This is the helicopter where they stick you in a, strap you in a helicopter cockpit, put it underwater, turn it upside down in the dark, and you've got to get out. So that's the sort of thing you have to do. Because that was for all ships fitted with helicopters, which of course ours was one.
So you did this. What were your first impressions on joining the Ashanti? And where did
if I could just say before.
Okay, sorry.
Before we joined the ship, the last course in this series, of course, was 3 weeks at the Maritime Tactical School in Portsmouth at HMS Dryer. Now, this is an advanced course for senior officers in tactics, and it's run by a team of specialists, commanded by a captain, and you do floor games, tactical games, floor games, not in simulator, but mainly floor games, providing solutions to various problems, deciding how you would act, and these courses actually have foreign officers on. Ours was a NATO course. You had to be a bit careful of security levels. You start asking a lot of outside nations, but we had Germans and Dutch and Danes, all specializations, all going in command, all senior jobs in command, right from lieutenant commanders up to captain. So it was a pretty high-powered course, and that was fascinating. I emphasize that because I then, after Ashanti, actually went on the staff of the tactical school. So then I joined Ashanti.
Now, what were your first impressions of the ship?
Now, I was very familiar with the tribal class frigate. So I knew the ins and outs of it. I also knew that it was actually quite difficult to handle, being single screw, and it was a twin gas and steam turbine propulsion system, so one had to be fairly careful bringing these things alongside. But there were great ships with more than the usual number of sailors, nearly 300. They were 3,000 tons, I suppose. And it was actually alongside in Portsmouth, all raring to go.
Now, what was your reception when you joined her?
Well, the guy I was relieving I knew very well, because he was a member of my long gunnery course. So that was the easy bit. And the amount of time you get to hand over in a ship, the captain's is the shortest. All he has to do is to sign for the confidential and secret books, which is, if he's got any sense, well, he'll check some of them, but he can't possibly check all of them. And a number of other signatures for various accounts and things, and take over responsibility for some of the secret and top secret stuff. And that's it. And you're talking about a couple of hours. And then you go and you shake hands with your predecessor, and off he goes to his farewell parade by whatever the ship's company got lined up for him. You just leave him to it. And you sit in your desk wondering where on earth you go, what you get to do next, and how it's done. And then, of course, you will send for your first lieutenant. Of course,
now, who was your first lieutenant? How did you get on with him?
He was, well, I had a couple, actually, and I got on pretty well with them. I got on very well. One I'd known, actually, who was a midshipman of mine very much earlier, Graham Rees-Jones, and he was excellent. He got him promoted in the end. He was an observer, Fleet Air Arm observer. The other guy I had was a torpedo specialist, not quite so strong. The engineer was a guy called Peter Wrigley. I mean, again, it's Sod's Law, as we call it. He was a lieutenant commander then, in charge of the engine room. We later met when I was commander of the Invincible, and he was commander E of the Invincible, so he was a good, strong character. And so the other special, they're a pretty good bunch, really.
Good officers.
Nothing. Yes, I don't complain. And the sailors were excellent, but the sailors were always excellent. I was fine.
How did you get on with the lower deck? I mean, how did you establish your relationship?
Very different as a captain. I think I've already said that the captain is not a member of the wardroom mess. He only ever goes in there by invitation. Now, any first lieutenant or second in command worth his salt will say to the captain, "You're welcome into the wardroom at any time, sir." But the captain, if he's got any sense, will know that it is a bad thing for the captain to be frequently always in the wardroom mess, because it's the only place the officers can go in and really relax. And if the captain's around, there's always that sort of sense. So the captain has his own quarters, and he eats up there. He has his own steward and his own chef, and he eats up there, and sleeps up there, and lives up there. You find quite often in harbour that the captain is maybe going to shore to call on various shore authorities, or go to the fleet headquarters to talk about the ship's programme, or go to the Ministry of Defence in London to talk about the movement of his officers. And so often he's not there. When I say often, that's perhaps not quite right, but it's total contrast to a sea where the captain is always there, of course, for a whole host of reasons.
Did you find it a bit lonely you've been used to the wardroom and that life. Did you find it a bit lonely being captain and sort of not part of the wardroom, or not formally part of it?
Terrible. Terrible, really, in a way. I mean, you sit up there reading a book and you can hear them having a party down in the wardroom. And you're dying to go down there. And occasionally they all come up and say, "Come down for a drink." Then you go down to drink. But you know that much as you'd like to stay on and chat to the girls they got in or whatever, you have a drink and have a chat, and then whoosh, you get back up to your thing again. So it was lonely, but that's what you were trained to do. You'd been in ships where captains stayed in wardrooms too often, not too long.
The problem was,
well, there was whenever the captain walked into the wardroom, no matter how popular and well thought of he was, a barrier came down with the other officers, with all the officers, to some degree. Now, and you could not totally relax and let yourself, you know, make sort of comments off the cuff or whatever. And the more junior officers, the more they clammed up because they wanted to do what, sure to say. And so there was this divide. Now, and I mean, some captains were very good, but there was always a slight sense of relief when the captain left. And this wasn't because he wasn't popular or anything like that. But there was always that sort of guarded attitude. And, of course, having been through that system, when you reach that exalted height yourself, you're very well aware of it, or you should be. So,
how did you try and establish a relationship with the lower deck? Because you're even further away from them. You know, I'm talking about the actual...
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. You actually are. And that was very much more of a I think, a conscious effort.
So how do you do
in harbour? In harbour, as captain, I always, if I was on board, either in the morning or both morning and afternoon, had a wander around the ship just to go everywhere that you felt like, just to pop in and have a quick word with them. Now, you didn't sort of hang about, because sometimes they were a bit tongue-tied.
And this isn't a captain's round?
This is totally informally. And I used to pop into the galley, and you know, if they'd made sticky buns for tea, I'd maybe have one of those. And sometimes I'd turn up in the servery for lunch just to see how they were getting on. And that way, you gradually get to know people. You will, of course, get to know mainly the people you work directly with, and the captain will get to know first of all. The bridge watch keepers, the quartermasters who steer the ship and who also meet and greet the security people on the gangway, he'll get to know them first. He'll get to know his own staff. He'll get to know his key senior ratings. Every day the communications yeoman will come to him with his signals, so he gets to know him very quickly. Other important people like the chief ERA or chief stoker, you build up this, the master of arms, of course. And that's how you do it. You probably at sea, you have less of a long line. You can't be wandering off around the ship all the time. Although I often used to, but I was always used to let the officer watch, had to know where I was, or the commander, or the first lieutenant know that I was, you know, wandering off around the ship. It was only fair that they should know.
Did you still have formal captain's rounds as well as these?
Oh yes.
Now, what was a captain's round from your point of view? I mean, now
formal captain's rounds were specifically, and they were usually it could be weekly or even two weekly, but they were usually rounds of various parts of the ship, and they used to be split up so you could usefully do it in a sort of an hour and a half, and you would have mess deck rounds when you went all round all the mess decks, heads and bathrooms, the living spaces, captain's rounds when everything had to be immaculate. You would have departmental rounds. You would have supply department rounds. You'd go and look in all the storerooms and the writer's office and the pay office and so on and so forth. You would have marine engineering department rounds where you go around the main machinery spaces. And the machinery control rooms and anywhere else that belonged to the engineering department. Weapons, electrical rounds were the weapon systems. So you'd split the ship up and the captain would do each in sort of rotation.
And would you find much wrong?
You were a poor captain if you didn't find anything wrong, because they always expect you to find something wrong. But it may be, when wrong, I'm just saying you make a... You know, run your fingers along the top of a lock and find come off with dust or something. You wouldn't have to say much. Or you find a lamp that didn't work or something like that. It was really minor stuff because, I mean, they really worked very hard beforehand because they knew that if they were not satisfactory, then they would be repeated.
Now, what was your duties at sea? You
Well, the captain overall, the captain is responsible for the safety of the ship and its men. He's responsible for the fighting efficiency of the ship. And between that, it covers all activities on board. And so your first really responsible is ship safety. And to that event, you've got to make sure you're going in the direction you want to go, that the navigator's got you on a safe course, and the ship's being navigated and steered and conducted safely. It's not going to run aground. And you've got to be assured that the engines are working within their capacity. The aircraft, if the helicopter's off, that's also operating within limit. There is an emergency, then it's dealt with properly. And we used to, every day, we used to practice, we had a fire exercise every day, in harbour and at sea.
And what were
you would practice man overboard, you'd chuck a body over the side and recover it by boat or bring the ship alongside or whatever. Sorry?
What sort of fire exercises? How real?
They were real insofar as, there were two types. You could either just have whoever was conducting the exercise, normally the first lieutenant or the officer day or somebody, would say, I want to fire in such and such a compartment exercise, and you would just do that. And you would then broadcast the alarm, sound the alarm, and then be there to make sure that the right people turned up very quickly with the right sort of equipment and the right sort of gear, and then you might ask them, well, what would you do, or whatever. That's a basic exercise. You then go on to more advanced exercise, and you might use a smoke cartridge to initiate smoke. What you've got to remember about that is that the ship's own firefighting system would react to that, so you have to be very careful. I mean, it's not normally as big. They can be quite big. Not like the big damage control exercises that you would have during a ship's workup at Portland, where they have major floods and damage and things like that.
Now, what about your role on the bridge? I mean, there's this picture of the captain being on the bridge a lot at sea. What's the situation? What's your role on the bridge?
Well, the normal reason for him being on the bridge at sea is for him to keep an eye on ship safety, and that includes mainly, of course, navigation. Quite often, the captain always had a rather nice chair up there, which I was always told was huddled on the Volvo lorry driver's seat. And you would sit up there and conduct your business up there, and you would be on tap for anything that need to be reported to you. For instance, there's a golden rule specified in the captain's standing orders that any ship which was going to approach closer than 2 miles had to be reported to the captain. That's any other ship. And other navigational aspects. And so you would spend a fair amount of time on the bridge because it was a convenient place for you to be. Everybody knew where you were, and you were on hand for any emergency of any sort. On the other hand, you had a perfectly competent officer watch, and it was not very good for his confidence if he had the old man breathing down his neck all the time. And so the captain could then normally retire to his cabin, or in the big ships his sea cabin, or even go off on a little wander around the ship for a short time and leave the officer watch in charge.
For a demonstration of your confidence in them as much as anything else?
Yes.
Now, what about your cabin? Had it at last changed?
Grown a bit bigger, but not that much. Yes, no, it had. I mean, it was... A commanding officer's cabin has to be sufficiently sumptuous and big enough to entertain visitors and guests. And I think we said have a table to seat 8 at dinner. That's 3, 3, 1, 1. Yes, 8 at dinner. And you had a separate sleeping cabin and, of course, a separate bathroom. And you had a separate pantry, we used to call it, which was where the steward used to do his washing up and with a serving hatch, peer through and see how you were getting on. And your day cabin, which was, you had a sort of folded dining table that folded up, and then bench settee seats around the side, and normally a sort of electric fire or something in the centre. and a desk with all your communications, because in your cabin you had direct communications always to the bridge, and of course comprehensive telephone system to various other parts of the ship.
Now, what about?
And you also had in your sleeping cabin a compass tape, magnetic tape, so you could tell an instant where what heading the ship was on.
How did you get on with your steward? I mean, it's like servant, isn't it?
Well, your steward, again, was normally picked for you by, it was one of the stewards on board, or maybe somebody who had been specially sent to do that job. I always got on very well. Great guys. You treated them right.
And what does that mean?
Well, you're very conscious of the fact that they, and this actually happens to a lot of aspects at sea with sailors, particularly if you're in charge of running boats and things, they've got to eat, and you see, you make sure that they get their time off and they get their relaxation, their recreation time, and that you can maybe do without them for a space of time or a certain length of time. And you treat them, the relationship is much more relaxed, and not, you don't treat them as a confidant, but you have sort of off the cuff and informal chats with them, and you joke, and you find out, first thing I did naturally was find out all about their family, and talk about that, and you talk about sport, and their runs ashore the previous night, and anything of inconsequence like that. They were very conscious of the fact that there was, you know, they were quite unique in the ship, especially that your steward, your chef not quite so much, because he worked in the galley as well, but the steward was unique in seeing you, and he would know who was coming in, and he actually had to be quite discreet. There may be things he overheard or that he saw people coming to see the captain that, you know, you don't particularly want spread around. Nothing was going around the ship without coming from that. And I was always very lucky. I had very good guys, and it's sometimes actually not a very glamorous type of job. And they were inevitably known as wardroom flunkies by the rest of the ship, which is a shame, because they were a great asset. And of course, they were also trained. First aiders or damage control specialists. They weren't just specialist thoughts of stewards. I mean, they did an absolutely essential job on board.
Now, so you've joined the ship.
Yeah.
Where are you going?
So, when we were shown to Portsmouth, we did some exercises in home waters.
You remember anything about them?
We did. No, it's mainly what we call KSEXs, exercises with submarines, navigation exercises, fairly sort of.
Are these working up exercises or just general exercises?
These were partly working. They were sort of refreshing exercises, generally. I've just remembered something, and I'm writing it down so I can remember to tell you in a minute. Right.
So what happens next?
Then we went on a series of visits.
Where to?
We went to Blyth in Northumberland. And I remember there. We were in part of a frigate squadron, and
which one? Sorry, should I say before?
Well, it was the 5th frigate squadron.
You were only with them for a while.
No. We were there for the whole time I was with the ship. But I mean, you didn't operate quite often as a squadron, but the captain of the squadron, who was a full foreign captain, wrote your confidential report on his frigate captains, and so he used to come with you from time to time. And I remember we took him up to Blyth, up in Northumberland, and going in there, it really was blowing a gale. It was quite sort of dodgy, and we got a pilot and actually came in alongside. It was quite hairy, I have to say. The weather was not really something that I would wish on anybody. The wind was blowing strongly, and there was a strong sea, and we got in fine without problem, shot in like cork into a bottle. And dear old Captain F was standing at the back of the bridge. He didn't say a word. And afterwards, when we got in, I said, would you like to come and have a drink? He said, I need a strong beer, neither. He said, I'm not so sure I would have tried that if I were you. He said, but you young people try. I think he thought that I should have, the weather conditions were such that I should have not gone into Blythe. I should have held off till it gone down.
But he left it to you.
Oh, absolutely. But he had to. There was no way that he could, I mean, it would have been totally, he had no authority to countermand my on board my own ship. He could only advise me, and he didn't. He was a great guy, though. I liked him. And then we had a superb visit. Very good liaison with the local police force, as we always did in the northeast. Lots of sport. I was taken off to a football match to see Sunderland play in a private box by a chap who owned a string of fish and chip shops, who drove a white Rolls Royce.
And how long were you at Blythe? Seems a strange place to go.
Well, it was one of the Blythe. We were there for 5 days. There were times when you were doing exercises in your ship's program where you could say where you wanted to go, depending on where you were going next or where you've been. The northeast is always very popular with the Navy, and you name any of those ports, Middlesbrough, Sunderland, Newcastle, of course. And then I was talking to the fleet programmer, and he said, well, nobody's been to Blythe for a while. How about trying up there? So I said, okay. And it was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And I achieved everlasting fame there, because I find out that one of my contemporaries at school, years before that, was currently the deputy head of the girls' high school in Blythe. And he brought his... He said, could he bring his sixth formers on board for a careers forum? And the sailors thought, this is wonderful that I'd arranged all this. So it's that sort of thing that happened. And my football match. And a night out with the chief superintendent of police, which was even more fascinating.
In what way?
Well, he took us to all sorts of places and clubs that I didn't know existed, never would have been, and we sort of sat in a corner, and he'd point out his villains to me, what they were. I don't think there's any great secret to say that we ate very well. I never saw any money pass any hands. There were four of us, actually. Me, the first lieutenant, and then two senior policemen. We went on... It was really going around clubs and going around the sort of seedy areas of Barrow to show them where my sailors may
Blythe.
Get to.
Blythe.
Yeah. Of Blythe. Show them where the sailors might get to. And... the sort of things they might get up to and where they prefer them if they didn't not to go. But the great thing about having a liaison, the Master at Arms would also have a close liaison with the police at his level, at sort of inspector level, local station level. And the great thing is that if there was any trouble, then the police would normally get hold of sailors and hand them over to us to deal with them. We'd get them on board and deal with them disciplinarily rather than have to go through the courts and things like that. Or let the trouble escalate to where it had to go to court. So we always had a very good liaison with the police.